Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Lecture Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Business Law, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service of public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and editorial review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on trade secrets when we come back. Well, back in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debts. Now, that clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Private business is carried on in gold and silver coin. Public business is conducted in commercial paper. Commercial paper, like stocks, bonds, Federal Reserve notes, credit cards, credit, debt, and usury. Well, back in 1965, our Congress said that there wasn't any difference in the value of gold and silver coin and that of clad coin or currency. And you know, that's true when we're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industries. But out here in the real marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in the purchasing power of gold over paper, and there's a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes that are due on that paper money that aren't due on that gold and silver money. Now, you know, God and our founding fathers didn't give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew that as a matter of law, gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for you and I to deal in order for us to establish our property rights. Well, neither did our Congress and politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason either. Those politicians knew, and they knew full well back in 1933, that in order to subjugate a free people, they would first have to take away the people's gold and silver coin, to take away the people's right to property, and to destroy those property rights. Now, if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacity, then we must first regain our property and property rights, and that's because property is the legal foundation for all of our liberties. So let me teach you how to do just that. That's in my business school, which is now on compact disc for adult home study. Now, if you'd like more information about our private business school, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package first. Now, that's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational. Best of all, it's free, and you can call right now. Remember the number, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. And our business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. And if you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for our free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Trade secrets. We've been talking about this thing of the secrets that go on in trade, commerce, business, and industry, which affects all of us, the public interest. My God, if we just knew some of these secrets over here, we'd probably save a lot of money, save ourselves a lot of grief. So last time we took a look at financial smarts and insurance. Let's start with credit tonight. Credit. There are 13 things here in trade secrets that you ought to know about credit. Starting off, they start with premium card traps, credit cards. They tell us don't be lulled into getting premium credit cards such as Master Gold Card or Premier Visa. The only significant premium is the $20 to $25 extra that you pay in the higher annual fee. Besides the fancy finish on the plastic, you get only marginally useful benefits such as travel insurance and protection on lost or stolen credit cards. Now, by law, you're liable for only a maximum of $50 if your regular card is stolen or lost and you report it within 2 business days. Now, the zero liability offered by premium cards is hardly worth that extra money. And there's a potential huge trap. Credit cards tied to home equity lines of credit. Banks are pushing them hard. The attraction is that interest paid may qualify for a full tax deduction under tax reform, and the bank's risk is minimal with the credit line, which is now secured by the equity in your home, which in your credit card, you're not putting up your house as collateral for your credit card debt. Home equity card rates are typically 1 to 3 percentage points above prime, and credit lines start at $10,000 and then go as high as $100,000. So what's the cardholder risk? Well, if you can't make your payments, you lose your house. Avoid premium card traps. Now, there's an easy way to get over this credit card addiction, too. People who are in debt over their heads often blame their credit cards. But in reality, most of the problems that we see are related to poor money management. Even people who are not in trouble may want to reconsider their use of credit cards unless they always pay the entire bill each and every month. The reason? Well, under tax reform, credit card interest is no longer deductible. It might be tempting to just cut up your cards and go cold turkey, but we live in a credit society, and it's important to learn self-discipline and good spending habits to take advantage of the convenience of credit cards. Well, I can't help it. I just have to make a comment. Convenience of credit cards? Convenience? No, it's an addiction. Human beings are motivated by these five motivators, and every salesman knows that vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear are those five motivators. Vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear, coupled to a credit card, guarantee irresponsible behavior and use of those credit cards. Now, 40% of credit card holders pay their credit card bill every month. 60% do not pay it every month. And the banks and the credit card issuers know that. So tuck it away in your heart. Unless you're an exceptional 40%, you're not going to pay that credit card off every month, and you're going to use that credit because it's available, and you're going to be motivated by your vanity to do that, or your jealousy, or your lust, or your greed, or your fear, one or more of those five motivators. So why don't you learn to limit yourself to two or three credit cards? I remember one time I had a credit card problem. I had 28 credit cards. I couldn't handle 28 credit cards any more than I could handle heroin or cocaine. And after all, that's what addiction is all about. It's something that you can't handle and you can't control. So if you get it down to two or three cards, can you handle two or three? Not very likely that you'll be able to handle those three, but it's easier to handle three than it is 28. Now, a bank card covers almost all purchases. Supplement this with a gas credit card and maybe a card from your favorite department store. So shop around for low-fee or no-fee bank cards, and don't get hooked into those expensive status cards that cost you $100 a year to be a member of the club. Then record your charges in a memo book, and because there's no written running balance as in a checkbook, it's easy to lose track of just how much money you're spending. And the issuers of the credit cards know that, and that's why they send those credit cards out to you, so that you won't keep track of how much you're spending. Now, you need to put a ceiling on your spending. Don't let the credit card company set the ceiling for you. They're only too happy to increase your limit every year because you're such a good customer. In that way, you'll be tempted to spend that much more. So beware. Sometimes applicants for a mortgage may have some difficulty obtaining the mortgage if they have a high credit card ceiling, even if they don't use that high credit card ceiling. You know, if you get $25,000 on your credit card, even if you don't use it, they could theoretically at least get into that much debt overnight. And so the mortgage company looks at that and says, oh, my God, this guy's got three credit cards, $25,000 each. That's $75,000. This guy overnight could bury himself under $75,000 worth of debt. Then you go in there to get a mortgage, and they look at you, and they say, now we're going to downgrade your credit rating. Now, here's another little trick. Spend no more than 20% of your monthly take-home income on consumer debt. This is a general guideline. Low income should allow a lower percentage. This includes car loans, credit cards, and consumer loans. If your monthly payments for debt exceed that amount, you're headed for trouble. So the solution to that is stop incurring debts until all of your credit cards are paid off, then follow a budget and do it faithfully. If you're heavily in debt from credit cards or any kind of unsecured credit, find a nonprofit consumer credit counselor who can set up a repayment program and appeal to card companies to lower your monthly payments until the debts are paid off. And it's best to pay as much as possible as soon as possible, since interest usually continues to accrue on all of the unpaid debt. The credit card companies make more money off of the interest. Same thing with Ford Motor Company. Now, you got Ford Motor Credit, GMAC credit. The most profitable part of General Motors is GMAC. The most profitable part of Ford is their Ford Motor Credit. Always tuck that away in your heart. They make more money off of the interest that you pay on those loans than they do off of the automobiles that they're selling you. The only reason they've got automobiles to sell is because they got to have something to sell you. And if they didn't have something to sell you, they wouldn't be able to charge you the interest. Now, use your savings as an alternative to credit cards. You know, too many people are forced to use credit in an emergency because they don't have any savings to fall back on. So change your approach. Save to establish an emergency fund with at least 6 months' income. Use the money only in an emergency and then pay back the money as you would a bill. Keep that money in gold and silver coin, and don't stock up on Federal Reserve notes. Your Fed notes are losing value at 10% a year. That's almost 1% a month. And it probably is 1% a month. We don't have an accurate number on it. You know, the Fed now won't tell us about M3, so we don't know how much money they're printing. But it's gobs. And that's what creates the inflation to start with. Now, I mentioned to you in the last program, I'm going to mention it to you one more time. This inflation here is a killer. Many of you people out there are planning to retire. You've been taught from childhood that you should retire when you get to be 65 years old. Now, there's not very many people who are going to retire, not from this point on, until this paper money collapses and a new paper money takes its place, or gold and silver takes its place. Now, listen up. If you remember last time, I asked the question, and I said, if you were going to retire for 20 years, in other words, this 2006, and you want to retire this year, and you're going to retire until you're 2026 when you expect to die, you need enough money to live on for 20 years. Going back 40 years, starting in 1966, how much of your income did you need to save in order for you to retire in the year 2006 for 20 years, assuming that you're 65 years old and you're going to live to be 85? The answer is you had to have saved 50% of everything that you produced from 1966 to 2006 to go along with your pension and Social Security in order to live 20 years at the same standard of living you did for that 40-year period. If you don't have that, you're going to take a cut. And it could be a pretty severe cut. And here's the next step. If you started in 1986 and saved for 20 years, 1986 to 2006, so that you could retire at the same standard of living that you had in 1986 for 20 years, from 2006 to 2026, what percentage of your income from 1986 to 2006 did you need to save in order to make that much money to retire on? And the answer is 100%. From 86 to 2006, you needed to save every dollar that you earned between 1986 and 2006 to maintain your 1986 standard of living. Now, that's where reality is located, and that's one reason that I didn't waste time retiring, and because I could see right away that there wasn't any retirement in the cards for George Gordon. What these people do is they retire, and then they wake up after 5 years and find out that they can't afford it, and then they have to go back to Walmart and become a greeter. Save your time. So you need to know what your goals are, and if you know what your goals are and you budget accordingly, you can save some money. So don't incur all this debt by trying to keep up with the Joneses. Know what you want out of life and then go get it. Here's a suggestion. If you write down your goals, a time plan for achieving those goals, and the approximate cost, how much money is it going to take, then determine which goals are important and focus your budget on the high priority items. Now here's a couple of credit card secrets. Credit cards are addictive. And people get hooked on credit cards because of their convenience, their power, their easy monthly payments. And most consumers do not even shop around for the best deal on credit cards. They sign on with the first bank that solicits their business, and almost invariably, an aggressive national institution is behind that credit card. Now, there's a thing called selective shopping. Selective shopping. You know, as a matter of fact, the most favorable card rates are offered by mid-sized regional banks. So anybody with a decent credit history can apply for and then obtain a card or a credit card from one of these regional banks, even if that bank is out of state. But they won't come to you. You have to seek those banks out. And here's how to do that. You start by exploring the banks near you. And if their rates are too high, then look to banks in states that have tighter lending laws. Now, three leaders are these three states, Arkansas, Delaware, and Oregon. You're looking for a bank now, a regional bank in Arkansas, Delaware, or Oregon, where the maximum interest charged is 5 percentage points over the federal discount rate, but never more than 17%. Now, credit card companies routinely charge 25 to 30% interest. Now, here's three states, Arkansas, Delaware, and Oregon. If you can get a credit card, you can get a credit card from a regional bank in one of these three states. That's Arkansas, Delaware, or Oregon. You have to search it out, where the maximum interest rate is 17%. And depending upon the federal discount rate, it can be even lower than that. Now, to find another low interest state, check the American Financial Services Association's annual summary of state consumer credit laws and rates available at banks and from the association, located at 1101 14th Street, Northwest Washington, D.C., 20005. Now, beware, don't assume that all banks in low interest states have low card rates. Several major banks have moved their credit card operations to states where interest regulations are less restrictive. One of those states is North Dakota, where there's no limit on interest. Now, there are some extras. In today's competitive lending market, many of the high-fee, high-interest banks are trying to seduce applicants with credit card enhancements. These extra services range from catalog shopping discounts to travel services to deals on everything from new cars to pest control. But unless you live in an isolated rural area, enhancements are rarely worthwhile, and any urbanite can get as good or better prices by shopping around. Now, there is a thing here called short billing cycles. You want to reject any bank that bills on a 24-day rather than a 30-day cycle. Check statements to find the billing cycle. You look at your statement. Besides confusing your home bookkeeping, this will cut into your float or your grace period, during which your loan is effectively interest-free, and also avoid any bank that double dips by tacking on an extra charge beyond the annual fee whenever you pay your balance in full. So if you had a $10,000 balance and you just paid it off, you know, they'd just tack on an extra fee. So watch out for that. And, you know, you want to be able to have the flexibility to pay your card off or to pay it down at your convenience, not the bank's. Now, you know, these are just simple little tricks, just simple little facts that can save you a whale of a lot of money. But I can do even better than that. If you don't have any credit cards at all, you will increase your standard of living by 20% because that's the interest rate. Well, that's the interest rate for 60% of you out there that have credit card bills. Now, I was just in class the other day, and I had a student come up to me, and he said, I need to pay off some of my credit card bills, and he's got $37,000, two cards with $37,000 on. Now, you take $37,000 times 0.18, we'll just take 18%. That's $6,660 a year interest on those two cards. Think of that. Now, these cards won't pay off for about 25 years. If you pay the 2% per month, it takes you about 25 years to pay them off. Now, take $6,600. It's just, you know, be reasonable. We'll call it 6,000 times 25. That's $150,000. So over the next 25 years, this guy's going to be paying $150,000 for $37,000 worth of credit. Now, if you deduct the 37 from the 150, let's just take 150 here, take 37 off of that, leaves you with $113,000. And that's three times the 37 now, isn't it? Three times. Remember I said you can add 20% to your standard of living by just getting rid of the credit cards. I did. Works out well for me. Now I'm not tempted to spend or overspend, and I'm not paying the bank that extra $113,000 on that $37,000. How this guy got into that debt, I don't know. But that's where he's at. And if he's an average Joe Sixpack, he's going to pay an extra $113,000 in interest over the next 25 years. And that's like buying a house. When you're buying a house at 6% interest for 30 years, you buy one house for you and two for the bank. Now, wouldn't you be better advised if you bought three houses over 30 years and you bought all three houses for you, and to hell with the bank? Now, in our business school, we'll show you how to do that. Now, I had an old buddy of mine in the ninth grade many years ago now, and I saw him at my last class reunion. Got to chit-chatting a little bit with him. His name was Henry. And Henry was an electrician who built six houses. He's out here working every day and wiring other people's houses, but he took his spare money, he took his spare time in his working career, and he built six houses in addition to the house that he lives in. Today, in Eureka, California, this guy, Henry, has six houses rented. Well, shucks, folks, if he gets $1,000 a month on each one of those six houses, which is pretty reasonable rent, two-bedroom houses in California, or two-bedroom apartments are renting for $1,400. Surely he's getting $1,000 for a house. You know, that's $6,000 a month retirement income, plus Social Security, plus his union pension. But he paid for all of those houses out of his own pocket, never went into debt, never paid any interest, and he built the houses himself. Now, he owns all six of them free and clear. My guess would be, if they're the national average at about $223,000 each, he's got seven of them, 223 times seven is how much? $1.5 million. So he's got $1.5 million estate paying him $6,000 a month for the rest of his life. And when he dies, he'll pass that on to his children. I say that makes a hell of a lot more sense than paying it out to the credit card companies in interest. Now, you may be able to withhold payments on a credit card used to purchase goods or services that prove substandard. Now, that's the result of a little-known provision of the Fair Credit Billing Act, which enables the credit card companies to reclaim disputed amounts from merchants after credit card slips are signed. Now, you've got to meet four conditions to be entitled to withhold credit card payments. Now, here's what it is. First, the amount of the charge must be more than $50. Second, the charge must be made within the customer's home state or within 100 miles of the customer's home. So it's got to be within your home state, and it's got to be within 100 miles of your home. Third, the customer must first attempt to settle this dispute with the merchant directly. And then finally, you, the customer, must give the bank that issued this card written notice that the attempt to settle has failed. And when the bank receives your notice in writing, it credits your account with the amount of the charge. Then it charges this amount back to the bank that services the merchant. And that bank then charges the merchant. Well, maybe you didn't know that, but there's a little known benefit to a credit card. If you're using a credit card and you're dissatisfied with the purchase and it's more than $50 within your home state, within 100 miles, and then you go to the merchant and say, listen, this thing is no good, take it back. And then you give written notice to the bank that issued the card, not to your bank, not to somebody else's bank, but to the bank that issued your card, written notice that you attempted to settle and it failed, and they'll take that off your credit card. What if you get a bad credit report? Do you know how to straighten that out? What do you do if you're dissatisfied with a credit bureau's file and would like to contest the information that's contained in your credit report? Well, under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, you're allowed to dispute any item contained in your credit file. And by law, the credit bureau is required to investigate and then remove any information that is not correct, but it has to be done in writing. So what if you're still unhappy with the credit agency's resolution? Well, even if you can't change the actual information contained in the report, you still have the right to insert a statement of 100 words or less explaining why you feel the report is inaccurate. And then that will be attached to and made a part of your credit report. Now, we're reviewing a book here called Trade Secrets, Facts That You're Not Supposed to Know. And it's put out by Boardrooms Incorporated, B-O-A-R-D, Boardrooms, R-O-O-M-S, all one word, Boardrooms Incorporated. Copyrighted back in 1996. You'll get it from Barnes & Noble, probably from Amazon.com also. Okay, we're talking about trade secrets, facts that you're not supposed to know. I'll be back with more right after this. The Law Hour, an editorial review, brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events from the scriptural perspective, and we do that 7 days a week. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour, an editorial review, gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed, at least in whole, by the Law Hour and editorial review. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. And they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. Remember, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives and can be accessed through our website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. Remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. All right, remember, we're talking about trade secrets, facts that you're not supposed to know. It's published by Boardrooms Incorporated, 196 pages, 315 things and 17 topics or 17 chapters about little-known secrets about trade, commerce, business, and industry that if you knew would save you a lot of money and probably save you a lot of grief. All right, we're talking about credit. Let's take a look at the IRS. They got quite a little section here on the IRS beginning on page 35. Now, the IRS section is the biggest. It has 55 tips that you can use in your everyday way of life to save yourself a lot of time, effort, and energy, and a lot of grief in dealing with the Internal Revenue Service. Some of the neat stories that they tell us is how to protect yourself. You know, knowing what to do if you receive notification of an IRS office audit makes all the difference in whether or not you survive that audit. So read the audit notice thoroughly. It tells you which items are being questioned and what you should bring to the audit. Now let me pause right there and point something out. Let's suppose for the sake of our discussion that the IRS asks for 4 or 5 items. It isn't necessary to bring 10 or 15. You take the subpoena, you bring into the office exactly what they ask for and nothing more. If you don't have it in your possession, you don't have to bring it in. But if you do have it in your possession, then the law requires that you bring it in. and that's the subject matter of the audit. And stick to that subject matter to the audit, and don't let this IRS agent now expand and go into a fishing expedition. That's up to you to object. Failure to object timely is fatal. Now, sometimes the IRS is just questioning one or two items on your return. If you have the records and the items are allowable, simply show the proof at the audit. Simple enough. You claim the interest deduction on your house, it was disallowed. There's a question about it. And so bring in all of your checks, all of your payments, and how much of it was interest and how much of it was principal. I remember one time they questioned my charitable deductions. I had a pretty good year some years back, and I gave a bunch of it away to charity. And they looked at that and said, why, nobody gives that much money to charity. Well, not very many people do. And how often do you keep track of or keep the receipts that you give to the Salvation Army or when you drop money into the kettle, you know, at Christmas time or something on that order? Well, there's no way for you to document or prove that you gave $20 to the Salvation Army's Christmas kettle. But the money that you give to your church, the money that you sent to the Red Cross or to any organization is accompanied by a thank you note from that organization with the amount, a receipt for the amount that you donated. Even if you don't have the receipt, they will have that record. So let's suppose that you gave $1,000 to the Red Cross or Salvation Army or the ABC Fund or whatever it is. You write a letter and you tell them, hey, my name is George Gordon, and last year I sent you $1,000. I need that receipt because the IRS is auditing me. And so make sure that you've got your name, address, and telephone number and zip code, because oftentimes they will put your donation down, and in their computer they use your zip code as the identifier. You know, George Gordon, 65676, and then they'll send you a receipt, and you can document that fact. So whether it's a bank payment or it's a charitable contribution, you know, any big corporation or any charity is going to keep track of all of their donations and all the money that comes in and goes out, at least for 6 or 7 years. Now, sometimes the IRS is just questioning one or two items on your return. So if they're questioning one or two items on your return, you're not required to come in there with everything that you've got. Just stick to the subpoena and stick to the facts. And if the guy says, well, by the way, do you have this? No, I don't. You didn't ask for it, and I didn't bring it. You asked for these items, and I brought these items, and I showed you plainly that I don't owe the tax. Cut it off right there. You know, oftentimes we give away more information than is required, and it comes back to harm us. It comes back to hurt you. And I know of many people that have gone into audits, and they get real nervous and excited, and they bring in boxes of stuff. It's what we call in law the loquacious witness. You ask them what time it is, and they have to tell you how to build a watch. They just can't shut their mouths. They're filled with self-importance, and look at all of these facts that I have at my fingertips. And so you go into the audit, and they ask you the two key questions. You answer the two key questions, and so the auditor, probing a little bit more on nothing more than a fishing expedition, says, well, by the way, do you have an extra job? Well, yes, I do. And how much money did you make on your extra job? Oh, I made about $10,000. Good. Did you file that on your tax return? Well, no, I didn't. You see, all of that superfluous information. Do you have another job? Excuse me, sir. Is that on the subpoena? Well, no, it isn't. Terrific. You sent me a subpoena, and I brought in the information you wanted, and I've answered your questions. Now, I don't want to sit here and waste my time on a fishing expedition. It's illegal, and it violates my rights. And then you stop it right there. You respond to the notice. If you ignore the notice, then the IRS may automatically adjust your bill. And you can rest assured that they're going to adjust it up, and then they're going to adjust it in favor of the IRS and opposed to you. Now, you usually have 10 days from the date of the notice to answer it. If you need more time, just write them a letter and tell them, I can't be in there in 10 days. I've got to have 30 more days. I'll give you whatever time you want. You know, within reason. I mean, they're not going to give you 3 years, but they'll give you 30 days. Prepare carefully. Review the return for the year to be audited, and then gather your evidence and your documentation from your files. Remember that story I told you about last time. You need the names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence. 7 items is what you use to prove your point. And you want to avoid a second appearance at the IRS office. IRS auditors don't work under a quota system, but the more time they spend on your case, the harder they will try to find adjustments. Find out the officer's working hours, and if the office closes at 4:30, don't make an appointment for 4. The audit may not be concluded in half an hour, and the last thing you want is to drag it out until the next day. The best time for an audit is in the morning, so that the auditor can finish your case and start the next one. Let the next guy come back 2 or 3 days in a row. And bring only relevant material to the audit. And if you include a lot of extra items of proof about other matters on your return, all you're doing is opening yourself up to the danger of an expansion of the audit. Now, frequently, your arrival at the IRS office coincides with the first time the auditor sees your file. He probably will not be interested in anything beyond the original matters unless you bring it up. Just deal with the items at hand as quickly and in the most organized way that you can. Where appropriate, provide adding machine tapes of checks or invoices that show grand totals agreeing with the line items on your return. And don't give the IRS original receipts or proofs. The IRS is notorious for misplacing paperwork. So make a photocopy of everything that you need. And then you give those copies to the agents. Never give up your originals. And in many courts, many jurisdictions, you have to have the original. It's called the original and best evidence rule. Now, if we want to go to trial, we have to have the original receipt or the original document. So always hang on to those originals. Replace any lost records right away. If it's possible, get a copy or statement from the original source, verifying the deductions in question. That's what I told you a little earlier. Just go to your church and tell them, hey, give me another receipt. They've got the record. You might not know how much you gave your church last year. You might not know how much you donated to this or that charity, but you can rest assured they'll know. Here's an example. If your medical bills are being questioned and you've lost your receipts, then ask your doctor to provide you with copies of them or a statement of what you paid for the year in question. Be cooperative. You know, instead of being a jerk, be helpful. The IRS auditor is only doing his job. He's, you know, the IRS guy's got a wife, nasty kids, a lawn to mow, and a mortgage and dog just like you do. And what's happened here is that your return goes through a computer, and the computer kicks out an item or two. They're not interested in the whole return, just that item or two. So come in there and show him that item is exactly correct. And then don't let him bamboozle you into giving him evidence of other things that might be a problem within your return. Maybe there is something wrong with your return. But if there is, it isn't up to you to bring it up. And it goes beyond the scope of the subpoena. So be cooperative. The IRS auditor is only doing his job. Starting the whole process with a surly attitude just works against you. You've probably got more than enough enemies. You don't need another one. It just makes the auditor much less willing to compromise, and he certainly is going to rule against you whenever he has to make a decision. And your courtesy may mean a more favorable decision. In other words, you know, it could be, yeah, you did goof up on your return, and maybe there's a 60% penalty that he could waive. So you owe him $500, but you don't owe him $1,100. You know, if he sticks that 60% penalty on there, it's going to jack your bill up. Just to give you a little bit of advice along that line, I was doing a court case one time, and the court clerk called me one day on telephone and said, "Hey, Gordon, you didn't file a response to this motion, and it was due 2 days ago." So I looked it up, and sure enough, he was right. I didn't respond to it. It was an oversight on my part, but you know, mistakes like that can get you dismissed out. So I apologized to the clerk, and I said, "Listen, I'll have it in by 4:30 today." And he said, "That'd be very helpful if you could get that in today." So I sat down and banged it out, had my secretary type it up, and I ran down to the courthouse, and I filed it. 2 days late, but I filed it. And the clerk took it, and it was a man, and he smiled, and he said, "Well, thank you, Mr. Gordon." So a couple, 3 days later in the mail, I received a copy of the filing that I had made for my records. And I looked at the filing date on there, and it was made on the date that it was due, not the date that I filed it 2 days late, but rather it was stamped in and filed on the day that it was due. Now, boys and girls, that clerk had to go get the key, come back and open up the time clock, set it back 2 days, stamp in my paperwork, reset the time clock, and then put the key back. Now, you know, if you deal reasonably with people, they'll deal pretty reasonably with you. I notice a lot of times, you know, people get pretty surly and nasty. You know, I'm a sovereign citizen, and you're just a crummy bureaucrat, and you work for me. You know, they get kind of uppity, and then you get in there, and this guy, maybe he's got a little bit of power. He ain't got a whole lot, but he's got a little bit of power, and he uses that power against you in any and every way that he possibly can. Avoid arguments with an unreasonable auditor. You may be confronted by an auditor who is discourteous or just plain unreasonable. So ask to see the auditor supervisor if you believe that you're being mistreated. You should also ask to speak to a supervisor if you and the auditor reach an impasse on proposed disallowances. Discuss the situation with the supervisor calmly. Now, the auditor has no authority to broaden the scope of the audit without the permission of the supervisor. You may not want to draw the attention of the supervisor to your return. And don't give in to pressure. Get professional tax assistance if the audit is too overwhelming for you. Go get H&R Block. Those boys will go in there and talk for you. If the auditor is obstinate about a deduction to which you believe that you're entitled, and you are sure that there are no other questionable items on your return, don't give it up. Stick it out. stop the action and tell the auditor that you'd rather wait until your tax professional can be present. Remember, however, that this will increase your exposure because of the second visit. If you have any doubts, then ask your professional to go to the first interview. When I was in the business world, I always had an accountant, CPA, put my tax bill together. Let me pass this one on to you, and I'll share a little trade secret. When I operated construction company and the manufacturing company, I had two very good CPAs. And the CPA would bring in he wants my records and books by October the 1st. So that the first 9 months of our operation, he has right there, takes him about a week. He runs through them, and he'll tell you, hey, listen, you know, you're really having a good year this year. You're going to have about a $50,000 tax bill. Now, if you're faced with a big tax bill at the end of the year, you need to do something to cushion that. And so Don Bell would say, you know, you need to buy another building. So then I'd call my realtor, and I'd say, listen, I got a lot of extra money here, and I'm going to have a pretty sizable tax bill. You know, I have to tell him exactly all the details, but, you know, I need to make a little investment of about $50,000 or $75,000, or maybe $100,000, whatever it turns out to be. And so, you know, find me a building so that I can get a tax write-off. Find me an oil well. Find me this or that or something else. And then your real estate guy, he'll go out and he'll find you. It's a sale to him. He's got a customer with money in his pocket. And so he'll find you a building. You buy the building before December 31st so that you can take the tax depreciation allowance for that year off. And so you reduce your tax bill and put the equity into your building instead of into taxes. So tuck that one away in your heart. A good CPA is worth his weight in gold. If he's got his head on straight at all, he's going to save you a hell of a lot more than you ever paid him. Now, CPA is going to cost you $1,500 a year to do your taxes, maybe more if it's a big, complicated tax return. But, you know, for that $1,500, I would expect him to save me $3,000. If I paid him $3,000, I'd expect him to save me $12,000. And they will. Now, the H&R Block and these mass operations out here, you know, those guys, you know, they're just going to hit and miss. But I'm talking about a CPA, not a bookkeeper, not an H&R Block. I'm talking about a real live CPA that can add and subtract, multiply and divide. Now, there are 55 things in this section on the IRS, 55 things. You know, you've got a penalty-free IRA withdrawal before age 59 and a half. A 10% penalty tax on early pre-age 59 withdrawals from IRAs does not apply if you take the money out in the form of an annuity. That is, in a series of payments spread over your lifetime. Now, it doesn't matter what age you are when the payments begin. There's no penalty, even if you're under age 59. The authority for this is the Internal Revenue Code Section 72T. To qualify for this exemption to the early distribution penalty, the payments must be part of a series of substantially equal periodic payments, and two, made no less frequently than annually, and three, paid over the individual's life or life expectancy, or the joint life or life expectancies of the individual and his or her beneficiary. There's a trap to this. If you use this method to take money from your individual retirement account, you can't change the payout method for 5 years, and you must be at least 59 and a half before you can make any such change. Now, oftentimes people will come here to school and say, you know, I'd like to get my retirement in cash and split and leave the same. And that's because your retirement, whatever you have in the bank in your 401k, is losing its purchasing power at the rate of 10% a year. Think of that, 10% a year. If you're saving money in a savings, a passbook savings account, you're losing 10% a year. And you say, well, I'm getting 5% interest. Okay, well, then you're only losing 5% a year in purchasing power. Now, you don't have to be real smart to figure out that you'd be better off if you bought wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil, or gold and silver, or copper, or anything, rather than hang on to that worthless paper. That's how bad it's become. All right, now, the best place to retire, to be tax-wise, you know, few people decide to retire to a particular state solely because of tax reasons. Most people select a retirement community because of friendship, relatives, or lifestyle. It's a warm climate, or it's a slower pace, but you can combine taxes and other reasons if you do a little planning. People often forget to factor in their estate taxes in thinking about a retirement state. Now, depends upon, I guess, what your retirement is, but if you're a fairly poor guy, and you don't have a whole lot of money, and you're thinking about retirement, or you're already retired, have you thought about living outside the country? There's a retirement community down at Lake Chapala in Mexico, Mexico City, over in Europe. You know, people that come from Poland or Czechoslovakia to the United States, work here, live here for 40 years, and then they go back home. You know, you can live on one-tenth, or you could live 10 times better in Mexico than you can here in the United States.
I'm California, two bedroom apartments, $1,400 a month. Hell, in Mexico, it's more like $50 or $75 a month. You know, you can live in a pretty splashy place if you've got some income coming in, you know. So if you've got $800 or $1,000 in income and you're just struggling, you know, to make ends meet where you live here in the United States, you know, if you'd move across the border, they'll send your Social Security check down to Lake Chapala or Mexico City or Guatemala or El Salvador or Costa Rica. And, you know, Costa Rica has a pretty stable government. So does Mexico. I don't think I'd be too excited about Guatemala and El Salvador, but I think Costa Rica and Mexico might come in pretty handy. Just a couple of pointers for you to keep in mind. I'm not here promoting, you know, leave the United States and go live somewhere else, but millions of Americans do that. In fact, 600,000 Americans a year move out of the United States, expatriate their citizenship, and become citizens of another country. 600,000 a year. That's 500,000. Now, while it's true that most people want to come to this country because this is the place to make money, if you're a retiree and you're having a hard time making ends meet, it certainly would be worth your consideration. And I had a student, he's actually not a student, but he's a TV guy. You know, I'm on his TV station from time to time. I run across him every once in a while out in Fresno, California. And he's got a house. He built a house for $50,000 in Monterey, Mexico. He said it cost him $500,000 if he'd have built it in Fresno. Now, he happens to work for the university. He's got a green card. He's an immigrant in Mexico. He drives up to Fresno, California, takes care of his TV station, drives back, and he's got servants in his house. And he works down there, and he makes a living. He's got his income from the TV station, and he lives 10 times better in Mexico than he could live in Fresno, California. And that's because of the differences in the money systems. So tuck it away in your heart. We'll be back next time. We'll be talking about this very same thing. Next time, your trade secrets, facts that you're not supposed to know. Remember, it comes from Boardrooms Incorporated, copyrighted in 1996. Just drop into Barnes & Noble or Amazon.com. You're looking for Boardrooms Incorporated. And the title of the book is Trade Secrets, Facts That You're Not Supposed to Know. Hey, we're about out of time. I got to remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like more information about the law school or The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults in compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. Now, The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.